Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and in particular, how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name is Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting today from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today's show is going to air on December 21st, 2007, the winter solstice. And what's new today? Well, obviously, we're in the midst of the holiday season. Actually, as I'm recording this, which is on December 6th, we're in the midst of Hanukkah, and when this airs, it's going to be just before Christmas, as I said, on the winter solstice. And there's also the Muslim holiday of Eid, I think it's called. So obviously all of these holidays have to do with the winter solstice, in particular with it becoming darker and darker each day. But as of the day you're hearing this, on December 21st, the tide is turning, yay, and it's going to start getting just a little bit lighter each day. Actually, when I was preparing this talk today, I started thinking about this, and I thought, you know, that's what homeopathy is like for me in my life and for my family. Homeopathy is like that little light in the darkness that gives me hope. I guess that's why I call this show There's Hope with Homeopathy. Why? Because no matter what happens, no matter how dark the world seems, no matter if people are afraid of an epidemic or serious disease, I feel that there's always some possibility of healing. There's never this feeling of it's hopeless. There's always a possibility of healing with homeopathy. It's that miraculous. And you know, that really, it's a big comfort in this world to know that there's something. Of course, it's true, homeopathy won't always do the trick, but at least you know that there's always this possibility that homeopathy can do the trick for in any situation. There really is hope with homeopathy. There's this potential, a potential for change with homeopathy. Just like the days, you know, that are slowly getting longer as of today, one day at a time, 1 minute each day, healing can happen, and it can happen in a very slow, gradual way. That's often the way it is with autism cures, especially with the cure of autism or like severe chronic diseases. People often say that people will cure at a rate that's proportional to how the disease came on. If the disease came on very quickly, like an acute, often it can be cured just as quickly. If it was a gradual thing, it often takes much longer. Now, I know many autistic kids become autistic very, very quickly as well. But in my experience, usually the autism cures are slow and gradual. Just like the days are going to get slowly, slowly lighter each day, almost imperceptibly, you don't really notice day to day how it's getting lighter. But after you look back, after a month or two, wow, it's really getting light out much later. And that's the same way with homeopathy. It doesn't seem like anything's happening, but after you look back, after a month or two, you'll see this change. Very often. That's why I often tell people, you know, take a log, you know, once, not every day, but once a week, record what's going on with your child's behavior. Sometimes you forget the improvement that's happened to them. A lot of times you come to your homeopath's appointment and they see this dramatic change. They haven't seen you in a couple months, but you haven't really noticed it because it's been so gradual. So for your child, keep a notebook of all the behaviors and everything that's going on with them. And then after a month or two, look back and see, gee, has there been a change? It's a really useful tool. Anyway, That brings me to today's show. Today we're going to have an interview show with homeopath Dr. Ian Lupker. And I'll introduce him in a minute. But he wrote to me and said, I want to call my show Increasing the Light, Moving Towards Recovery with Homeopathy. So that fits in very well with what I was just talking about, moving towards the light. But before I get to that, let me just do my usual intro to what this show is all about, which is an intro to homeopathy based on my book, Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy. And you can find out all about the book and much more at the book website, which is impossiblecure.com. So there you'll find a very comprehensive page about autism, including referral lists to homeopaths. Also, the annotated archives of this radio show, which we're going on now 3 years of this radio show, are available at the archives. Just from the homepage on the right side, there's a link to the archives. there's also the Cure Stories database, and please send me your cure story, even if it's small, even if it's not complete. These short stories help convince other parents to try homeopathy for their child. So it's really a good deed to send me your story. You can find out how to order in bulk. Well, maybe it's a little late now for Christmas, but you can get discounts on bulk orders if you buy some for your friends, for a study group, for a class, whatever. And always feel free to send me questions. I do respond to people's emails usually within a week. Just email me at lansky@impossiblecure.com or alansky@autism1.org. All goes to the same place. Okay, well, just before I introduce Ian and bring him on the phone, just to let you a little bit about what's coming up, 2008, just around the corner, and I'm contemplating this might be my last year of the show. By the end of 2008, I'll have 4 years of shows, and perhaps Autism One will rerun them, but my inclination right now is to wrap it up with the 12 more shows of 2008. And I'll be beginning in January with a recap on philosophy. I'm going to call the show The Homeopathic Way of Thinking. So many times people, I mean, even myself, it takes years and years till you start thinking about the body and treating the body, not in the allopathic standard way where you just take a medicine for this or that. It's so hard to get over that way of thinking about health and disease. So I'm going to be reiterating, going back to philosophy, I think, which was the topic of my second or third show 3 years ago. But it's never could be talked about enough, really. So I'm going to go back to that topic. So today's show, as I said, is an interview with Dr. Ian Lupker, who is a naturopathic physician practicing in Washington and Oregon states, and his practice is in Ashland, Oregon. So he graduated from the National College for Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and is board certified in homeopathy as a naturopath. So he practices only homeopathy. He specializes, though, in the pediatric treatment of autism spectrum disorders and other behavioral, developmental, and learning issues. And many of you may have heard of him because he is co-author, along with Drs. Robert and Judith Reichenberg-Ullman, of a popular book in this community, which is A Drug-Free Approach to Asperger's Syndrome and Autism, Homeopathic Care for Exceptional Kids. In addition to studying homeopathy, in the United States, he also studied in India, in Bombay, at a homeopathic hospital for 8 weeks. And he has worked here in the United States for over a decade in both conventional inpatient, outpatient, and obviously alternative settings. And specifically, he's focused a lot in psychiatric settings. So this really is his specialty. He lives and practices now in Ashland, Oregon, where he enjoys hiking in the mountains and playing banjo and guitar. I'll have to ask him about that because I love banjo. Anyway, and he shares his office in in Ashland with an exceptional homeopath, Dr. Deborah Gordon, MD, another naturopathic, oh, she's an MD homeopath, Deborah Gordon. So he treats people in person and also by phone consultation. So to find out more about Ian Lupker's practice, you can go to madronahomeopathy.com, which is M-A-D-R-O-N-A, homeopathy.com. And the number there is 541-482-2824. And his email is ilupker, which is I-L-U-E-P-K-E-R, at earthlink.net. Okay, so without further ado, I'm going to bring on Dr. Lupker. Hello?
Hello,
Amy. Hi, Ian. Hi.
Hi.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I've already introduced you, so why don't we begin by having you kind of introduce yourself by telling us how you got interested in homeopathy.
Yeah. Well, first, I really want to thank you for having me on the show. This is really exciting for me, and I want to thank you for everything you've done in terms of writing your book and not only educating the homeopathic community, but also making homeopathy accessible and to parents of children on the autism spectrum.
Well, thank you.
I think it's really been a blessing and created a lot of light in writing your book. And, you know, this is a time of where the days are getting shorter and the nights are getting longer. It's a real time of darkness, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's the third night of Hanukkah, and we're moving towards Christmas. And it's a time of darkness, and I want to acknowledge that, but I also want to acknowledge that, especially with homeopathy, you know, what I feel like we're doing is within fulfilling the healing promise of homeopathy is really increasing the light, increasing the light of engagement with these children, with their families, with their loved ones, with parents, with siblings, increasing the light of relating, that recognition, you know, just being in a state of presence with another person, with a family member, with a sibling. I think that homeopathy has this potential to increase the light of that child's inner being so that it can really glow and burn brightly and illuminate people around them. And I think it's not only a one-way street and moving in that direction, but there's also a component to being able to receive the illumination of and the glow of the warmth and the love and the joy of family members and parents, siblings, and extended family, and the greater community, to be able to bask in that glow and that light. And I feel that homeopathy is able to go really deeply in increasing that light. And, you know, I think that this is really what homeopathy is capable of doing, and this brings a lot of, there's a lot of hope, and I think miracles are possible with homeopathy.
There's actually, in my book, there's one vignette, it's in that Cure Stories chapter where a woman talks about her experience of what it's like to be on the remedy.
Uh-huh.
And she actually, and this was, you know, an adult, and she said that it was like before she was cut off from the light, and then it was like she was hooked up to the light. And she kind of meant also kind of in a spiritual sense, you know,
yeah.
Like you're saying. What you said really is beautiful. It reminded me of her statement of her experience.
Yeah, you know, I've heard other parents of children on the spectrum talk about, you know, how they felt like their child before homeopathy was kind of in a fog, you know, in this darkness, and that after treatment, you know, that light shining more brightly, that fog lifted, and it was able to be burned through, and they were able to come out and really, you know, illuminate others with communication and social interaction and all those beautiful things that we're capable of as human
find out about homeopathy? Was it at naturopathic school? Or
it preceded that. This was in the mid-90s. About three things came together, three experiences that were really influential in my life. First of all, I was treated homeopathically myself by a very talented classical homeopath in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And so I was able to experience directly, firsthand, what it means to be healed on a mental, emotional, and physical level. And I was in awe that something so gentle and so subtle could have such a profound and deep healing impact on me. And so that really moved me. And I come from a family of physicians, like uncles and grandparents, and a lot of doctors in my family, and I was really inspired and quite frankly in awe that something so subtle and so gentle could be so powerful. And the other two experiences, around the same time I was working with a man dying of bone cancer. I was doing some hospice care. And this man was a really, really beautiful, special person and had been sober for 20 years. He had gone through AA and sobered up. And had been a counselor and really helping many, many people move towards sobriety and reclaiming their lives. And we had these, you know, kind of Tuesdays with Maury talks about the irony of here he was at the end of life with bone cancer, which can be extraordinarily painful, hooked on narcotic pain relief and opioid-based pain medication. And so our discussions really hinged on what healing modality could be useful in controlling pain and at the end of life, and at the same time helping maintain mental lucidity and clarity in a person at a time when it's really important to be able to connect with loved ones, to tie up loose ends, to say one's goodbyes. And so this was really powerful for me to be having these conversations, and it drove me to really want to study this in more depth and to go to naturopathic school and to study homeopathy in particular. And the third experience was working in the mental health field. I, for over a decade, and at the same time I was still working in the mental health field, both in inpatient and outpatient psychiatric settings. I really saw the extremes of mental illness and how devastating it can be. And, you know, interestingly, Hahnemann was really one of the early pioneers in the humane treatment of people with mental illness.
This is an area that's actually dear to my heart, too, because my brother is schizophrenic. And so, I know a lot about this whole thing.
Yeah. It really can be very devastating, and I want to say that I think that we should be thankful that we do have psychotropic medications available. That, you know, I have seen them be very helpful to people and really help people pull their lives together. And on the other hand, I saw a lot of people in these units who weren't responding, or the side effects were just so horrible that it made taking the psychotropic medication or psychiatric medication untenable. And so that also drove me to want to study a healing modality that could address the mental, emotional aspects of people's experience in a way that was gentle, in a way that was really deeply transformative and not just superficial. And so those three things are really what led me to the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon. And I really made my focus, I really wanted to study homeopathy, and so I took every clinical opportunity available that arose. I was doing mentorships and preceptorships, and helped organize a trip to Sri Mama Devi Hospital in Mumbai, India, Bombay, where, you know, we studied with some fantastic Indian homeopaths. And, you know, just as a side note, I want to add, there are a few Indian homeopaths that have really made a big name for themselves, and they teach internationally, Rajan. Yiddish. But there's a lot of Indian homeopaths just working in the trenches, seeing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of patients that are just exceptional. And at this hospital, we really got it, the other students that I was with, and myself, we really got to see the potential of homeopathy. You know, in India, they're not as constrained as we are in the West with fears of liability and all of this, in what they'll treat. So we saw, you know, we saw a man that had been bitten by a cobra snake come in, and we treated him successfully. We saw cases of leprosy, of HIV, of late-stage diabetes, of septicemia, you know, really extreme pathology that we wouldn't touch here in the United States, typically, but I saw it treated successfully, and I have to say that that experience was really formative, because I was able to experience firsthand and recognize the potential, healing potential of homeopathy, and it's deep.
It's amazing. It's, you know, it always surprises me when I hear, sometimes I'll hear a homeopath say, oh no, we can't treat that with homeopathy, but since my first experience was my son's cure, so my tendency is to think almost everything can be treated with homeopathy. Anyway, there is hope, you know. There's always some hope. So tell me, so let's focus now a little bit on your treatment of autistic kids, and your practice sounds like it's mostly kids on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I was driven in a way towards wanting to study naturopathy and homeopathy because of my hospice experience, and I went into school thinking that I was going to do primarily end-of-life care and hospice care, and as life would have it, I ended up doing primarily pediatrics, which I absolutely love. And, you know, part of the beauty of it is that kids typically respond so quickly to homeopathy because their vitality, by and large, is still really intact, and they have strong vital forces, a lot of children, not all of them, but whereas adults often, you know, they've been exposed to so many conventional medications which have laid layers on them of suppression that need to be removed, you know, emotional traumas, grief. You know, it's so rewarding and fulfilling to work with kids because often they respond so quickly to homeopathy. So, yeah, my practice, I would say, is about 75% kids, and I would say a majority of that, 60% plus, is working with kids on the spectrum. You know, since the Ullmans and I co-authored this book on homeopathic treatment of autism, I've really worked a lot with kids on the spectrum and related conditions as well. You know, as we know, there's comorbidity or other conditions that occur simultaneous often with ASD. So I work a lot with OCD, work a lot with depression, especially when, you know, kids on the spectrum get into adolescence, which can be a difficult time for any you know, teenager. For kids on the spectrum, Asperger syndrome, it can be really, you know, that marginalization and that they are really coming face to face with, you know, the social difficulties that they're having, and often can feel on the social fringe, can be marginalized, can be bullied. And so depression and anxiety isn't such an uncommon comorbid feature that we'll see with the children on the spectrum when during adolescence.
I actually read an interesting article. I get you know, the newsletter from the Autism Research Institute, you know, Bernard Rimland's whole organization, and they had an article that said that they're discovering that anorexia may be an ASD, which surprising to me, but that there were certain factors that were, you know, I don't know, similar between anorexia and, like, Asperger's, so... Interesting.
That is interesting, and it makes some sense. I mean, mean, I think that one of, you know, talking about healing light of homeopathy, I think that one of the landmarks that I use to determine if a case is moving in the right direction, you know, I think about healing in terms of freedom. And I think that with children on this, and adults on the spectrum, that, you know, there's with often OCD, for example, is involved, obsessive compulsive kinds of behaviors. But there's often a lot of control issues, and you know, this makes sense in terms of anorexia as well, and controlling the intake of food. And I think that one of the landmarks that I use when I'm determining whether a remedy's been effective or not is that control, that some of those control issues become a little less predominant. That there's more freedom, there's more choice. That a child doesn't need to be constricted by, you know, doing things in a certain order in order to get out of the house to go to school that morning. And anorexia, I think, is, you know, it's a similar kind of thing where, you know, a freedom from that, from needing to have a specific sequence of events take place in order for the next step to occur, or be able to transition more easily to the next activity, is another example of this. But if there's freedom in that and not such a strong need for control, I think that's a sign of healing.
Right. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what patients, like your patients, can expect when they come to see you, and, you know, how can they prepare, how can they do better with homeopathy? Just tell us a bit about your practice, maybe with some examples.
Yeah. Excuse me. So I, you know, I've got a fairly comprehensive questionnaire that I'll send out. You know, I treat people both in person and by phone, and, you know, so I've got patients all over, from Australia to New York to California to Texas, all over. And so I'll send out a questionnaire, often by email. And it's very comprehensive, and often if it's a long distance patient, I'll have the parents sometimes send me some video footage of their child, so that I get a sense of more of the gestalt of how are they moving, you know, how is their motor planning, both gross and fine, what does a tantrum look like for them, you know, how are they engaging? When dad is asking them a question from across the room, how are they responding to that? You know, what degree of joint attention are they sharing with people around them? How are they engaging? How are they relating? You know, what is it about their environment that they're responding to and reacting to? So, you know, this can be really helpful, having some video footage of a child, particularly if they're long distance. But I've also, you know, in the time that I've been doing phone consultations, I feel like I've really cultivated a way of hearing and really tuning into what the parent is expressing, and what's important in that, and in what the, if the child is verbal and the child is able to have a conversation with me on the phone, be able to really listen carefully for, essentially, you know, what is strange, rare, and peculiar? What is most characteristic? What is most unique? I mean, I think this is the core of homeopathy. We're looking for what's individualizing. And I have to say that although in homeopathy we talk about treating the person, not the diagnosis, it is really important in my experience, especially working with a condition as complex and having such a global impact on a child on the spectrum, that we're really, I lost my train of thought here. that we're really trying to understand how is this child different from any other child on the spectrum, and I think that only comes with experience of working with many kids on the spectrum. And also, how is this child different from a neurotypical child? So it's important to see a lot of kids that are neurotypical as well, in order to compare. But we're really, you know, interested, I'm very interested in what is most individualizing, what is most unique and characteristic. And so, you know, I'll spend 2 hours with a child and their parents, and we'll start with the pregnancy. Frequently, that's really important information. What was the mother's pregnancy like with this child? Were there any traumas that were experienced? Were there any medications or any environmental exposures that the mother potentially could have had? What was the child's infancy like? When did they meet their milestones? What were they like as toddlers? You know, what is their nature? And also, you know, what's going on physically for them as well? You know, often these children will have issues going on with their GI tract, their gastrointestinal tract. You know, is there asthma? Is the child having headaches? I mean, I'm really interested in the child head to toe, mentally, emotionally, and physically. So during this two-hour period, I'm really trying to understand the child inside and out. And what's so wonderful about working with children on the spectrum, particularly ones that are, you know, are verbal and can express their experience, you know, with the special interest or the grand passion, they're willing to talk about that forever. And you know, these are the you know, often I'll talk about following the energy in a case. So when a child gets excited about something and it's something that they're passionate about and clearly brings a lot of joy, and I see their eyes light up and I see them really get in hand gestures and all the excitement around what they're interested in, there's a reason that they're interested in that. And so I you know, and my ears perk up and my eyes widen, and I really want to help them. I want to facilitate their elaboration of explaining why, what it is that they're so passionate about that particular interest. What is it about that interest? And, you know, it's the same thing with dreams. It's the same thing with, you know, what do they like to play? What do they like to do with their friends? All of these things are really important and interesting in leading one to the right prescription. So, you know, the two-hour interview, I mean, sometimes it's amazing to me that we can get enough information to prescribe upon in just 2 hours. And, you know, often I will sit and think about a case and really put it together, put these puzzle pieces together in a coherent way that leads me to the right remedy in the materia medica. And often, you know, after studying up a case for sometimes 5, 6, 7 hours, you know, I'll return to the parent or the child and ask some follow-up questions to try to confirm my prescription.
Do you think that the stim, like the child's particular stim, is revealing at all?
You know, I think stims are revealing. The whole sensory aspect and sensory integration or sensory processing disorder aspect to ASD, which is so prevalent, is really fascinating to me. And, you know, I want to talk about this a little bit later, but, you know, the stimming, that repetitive behavior, you know, whether it's flapping or whether it's stroking the mother's hair, you know, there's some kind of, or whether it's making a vocalization, or you know, the visual stim of, I had a patient who would tear Kleenex strip by strip, and they were perfectly even strips, and he would vocalize as he was doing this. You know, I think that these kinds of repetitive experiences, these perseverative, you know, these stimming experiences that give a sensory experience to the child that's repetitive and coherent, you know, I think it makes sense to me that it's somehow calming and pacifying. And, you know, in some ways, you know, I think it's I think about it in some ways as, you know, it's disturbing, you know, sometimes for for people to see a stim like that. But sometimes I think for the internal experience of the child, it's somewhat similar to the prayer or to reciting a mantra or something that, or something that's a repetitive kind of activity that can be very calming and integrating to the nervous system.
You know, sometimes people write to me and they say, you know, after they've begun treatment with their child, and they say, well, you know, certain things are improving, but the stimming is increasing, which alarms them. But I've heard, and I try to assure them that this can be a positive thing, because the child is starting to, you know, sort of come, is trying to make contact, which is kind of also nerve-wracking for them, and so the stim is, you know, calms them. So that's why the stimming might increase as they're making more contact with us.
Yeah.
What is your view on that?
Well, you know, I think that there's a case that I'll be talking about in a minute where, you know, we would know when it was time to redose the remedy, when the stims return. That was one landmark that we were using. And interestingly, each time this child would take his remedy again, within 2 to 3 days, often within 48 hours, his stims would completely stop. And so we, you know, and he would need his remedy every 6 months or so. But I think it's also, you know, it is true. I mean, I think that one of the important aspects in helping a child move towards recovery, and for neurotypical children as well, is, you know, being able to integrate one's sensory experience and to be able to self-regulate emotionally. And in some ways, you know, stimming is about this. I think in adults with high functioning autism, we'll talk about this, that stimming is calming for them and it is pacifying. And I think it's a way of being able to self regulate.
So why don't you move on then to some of those cases?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and while we're on this topic of stimming and sensory processing and seeking out some sensory and sensory experiences, you know, one of the things that I've been really interested in a man's work, he's a developmental psychiatrist on the East Coast named Dr. Stanley Greenspan, and he introduced a concept to me, which, you know, Gene Ayers and other occupational therapists have been working with as well for many years, since the 70s. But, you know, I came to think about, you know, and orient my questioning during an interview to try to understand what kind of sensory profile is this child experiencing. You know, are they overreactive or hyperreactive to stimuli, to sensory stimuli? Are they underreactive or hyporeactive to stimuli? Or are they sensory craving? And so these are three categories, and sometimes there's a combination of the three of those, but you know, I think that integration of the senses in terms of being able to have a coherent experience and creating a internal experience that enables a child to engage with the external world, if you can work with the sensory integration or sensory processing piece, it goes a long ways in helping a child on the spectrum. And so here is a child that I have worked with for a few years. And this boy, in fact, the family of the boy who I'll be sharing his case, have written into your recovery stories. So they have, you know, written in their story, and so it's there on your website, The Impossible Cure. And so I'm gonna paraphrase what they've written, because I think it's better, you know, from the parent's mouth than from mine. It's more direct in terms of specifically what their child experienced and what they observed in terms of their child moving towards recovery. And I think that both, you know, in my observation and in their experience, this child is recovered. Definitely a sensory craving child. And his father writes, "Our son's story probably begins the same as a lot of children on the spectrum, a lot of autistic children. His diagnosis of autism came as a surprise to us, but as a relief that we could put a name to what was happening to our little boy. His autism wasn't only a diagnosis, but it was his prison. And, you know, this is in terms of this metaphor of light that we've been talking about. You know, a lot of parents will describe this darkness that they feel that, or the fog that their child is enshrouded in. And, you know, part of the fulfilling the healing promise of homeopathy is increasing that light and lifting that fog. His life was controlled by his obsessions, which consisted of the color red, lining things up, playing in water. He would flush the toilet approximately 20 times a day. He would play with his spit and feces, was doing a lot of hand flapping. He wanted to be squeezed. And he, you know, in the office I observed this. He would say to his father, "Squeeze me, squeeze me, squeeze me." And that deep pressure, like a lot of kids with sensory processing issues, was very calming to him. And so his dad would give him a big bear hug, and this boy would just squeal with delight. And, you know, I think it was really, it would help him integrate that deep pressure. And occupational therapists have been working like this and doing great work. His other obsessions were ripping paper, and he was a spinner, you know, that vestibular apparatus, and stimulating that. And he would run towards the vacuum cleaner and to stim on the sound. And would also like really spicy foods, which is an oral kind of stimulation. I think, you know, spicy is very stimulating orally. And would love music and dancing. He experienced constant diarrhea, and he was very picky about what food he would eat. He refused to play with other children, and this really hampered his social skills, obviously, because he was really kind of a loner and on the fringe. At age 2.5, he could speak only 5 words, and his frustration from his inability to communicate usually resulted in fits of crying, and which is really not that uncommon, you know, to not be able to express oneself and to get one's needs met verbally. You know, can be very frustrating, and I see this happen a lot. Had poor coordination and gross motor skills, which is also quite common. He would focus on one thing and could do it for hours, such as ripping paper or watching water flow from the sink. When Parker was 3.5, we met with Dr. Lupker, and our little Parker, who seemed like a boy lost in the fog without control, and again, I think about this darkness metaphor, was finally found. Within a week of giving Parker, I gave him a homeopathic tarantula. His obsessions with red, his playing with his spit and feces, and lining things up began to disappear. Slowly, as the months went on, we would see improvements almost weekly. And again, to reiterate what you had said about after the winter solstice, December 21st, which is when actually the show will be aired, the days will start growing longer, and I think that homeopathy can make very, sometimes it's sudden and instantaneous, and there's this beautiful response, it's always what I'm hoping for, but sometimes it's more subtle, and, you know, the movement towards recovery is more gradual, but consistent, and that's certainly what happened with Parker here. He began singing songs, talking in sentences, and communicating. His appetite grew, and by putting him on the gluten-free diet, his diarrhea cleared. The spinning, the ripping, and the flapping all diminished. And for once, he began to actually look at us, parents, as though we were more than just objects. He looked at us, hugged us, and communicated with us. So that light of engagement is starting to burn bright here. At the age of 4, Parker was potty trained, which was something we weren't sure we were ever going to see happen. Today, Parker will eat almost anything put in front of him. He still thrives with order, but enjoys using his imagination and playing with other children. He's 5 years old now and is in a regular kindergarten, neurotypical kindergarten class. He still likes to spend a little time ripping paper and continues flapping his hands, which is calming for him. excited, but the fog has cleared, and he is a very happy person. For us, the challenges are not over, but the day we found homeopathic care, we found hope, and 2.5 years later, we have found unimaginable success. So, you know, this is really a recovered case, and to lift that darkness and to, you know, I really see homeopathy as helping this child to really shine his light of engagement, communication, happiness, being able to integrate into a kindergarten, a regular kindergarten class. You know, his GI tract, his diarrhea has cleared. The need for spinning and ripping and flapping is all diminished. But, you know, mainly he's engaging. He's looking at his parents as if they're more than just objects. He's hugging them, communicating with them, interacting with other kids. This is all, you know, the healing power of homeopathy.
It brought tears to my eyes. Mm. It kind of reminded me of with my son. Mm. And, you know, and by, like, 5, we also felt he was, I would say, you know, I always say now, like, 80%, you know?
Yep.
And then the other 20% was just gradual, you know?
Yep.
So just parents have to be, you know, patient.
Yeah.
Just patient.
And we can talk about this a little bit later as well.
Yeah,
but
we have about 10 minutes. Oh, so I want you to
okay.
Think
let me
about
let
that.
Me just let me go into another case really quickly then. You know, and I also want to say that in addition to homeopathy, you know, of course I'm certainly more oriented in what are the least invasive, what are the less invasive interventions, and I think as a naturopath. You know, I think that there's some dietary influences or environmental influences that can be obstacles to cure. And so in terms of removing those obstacles and working, you know, removing gluten from this child's diet, you know, helped his GI system considerably. And I think in combination with homeopathy, really understanding what are the obstacles dietarily that are creating a problem, an obstacle for the child's vitality to really come through and to be strong, removing those obstacles are important. I think that's an important part of working with these kids. And in addition, as I had mentioned earlier, Dr. Stanley Greenspan, you know, I really think that there's some good, he's got something called DIR floor time, and floor time is something that can be used with children anytime. And it's essentially, it's figuring out what is this child's sensory profile? What is their unique biological profile? Are they overreactive? Are they underreactive? Are they sensory craving? It's recognizing what their passion is. What brings them joy? What fills them with happiness? What is their passion? And utilizing that passion as a vehicle for engagement. And just one quick example here that Dr. Greenspan works is a girl who would stim by stroking her mother's hair. It was soothing for her to play with her mother's hair. So Dr. Greenspan recommended that the mother, and recognized that there was a lot of passion in this girl's stroking of her mother's hair, and that she got a lot of joy out of it. So Dr. Greenspan recommended that the mother get a wig. And when the girl starts stroking the wig, the wig falls off. And suddenly, you've set the stage for this theater of engagement. You've got this prop, which can be used as an object for joint attention, and you can use that prop, this mother would use that prop to engage her daughter. Uh-oh, what happened to the wig? It fell off. That's not mother's hair. What is that? And suddenly, the child is looking at her mother, looking at the wig, trying to figure this out, and there's a stage that's set for an engagement, and so, you know, I think that kind of counseling, and that can be used in so many different, it can be used throughout the day, and I think it's an important part to get at that last 20% that you're talking about. So here's another child, there's another case that I'll go through. This is a more overreactive child, an 8-year-old boy who had Asperger's syndrome and sensory processing issues, fascinated with how things work, would stare at a cell phone for hours. He could count in 3 languages at a young age, very sensitive child. Really, the primary issue is self-regulation of his emotion. and he would get overwhelmed easily. And his reaction to getting overwhelmed and not be able to self-regulate, he would hit his head with his hands, smash things around him, yell, tantrums. The triggers were often sensory, sound, and foods, and has done really well in the gluten-free, casein-free diet. I'd appreciate it if you didn't talk, he would say to his sibling and to his parents. This boy would scream himself to sleep sometimes when he was feeling overwhelmed and was constantly waking at 2 a.m. in the morning. Had a throat-clearing tic, and of course tics and Tourette syndrome, because they're a neurological condition, often are a comorbid feature of ASD. Very mischievous kid. He would love to play antics. He'd break a dozen eggs on the kitchen floor just to watch his mom's reaction, and then laugh somewhat sardonically as his mom cleaned up the eggs. He'd take his sister's toy, pretend to harm it while laughing at her fear and discomfort. He really enjoys pushing other people's buttons, his mom would say during the initial interview. So belladonna was really the remedy that helped him globally. It helped with his sleep. He was less overwhelmed. There was an increase in emotional regulation. He was less reactive to sensation, and the sensory processing piece really became integrated. And, you know, I think that went a long ways. I think I already said this, but I think that if you can integrate the senses and, you know, create those vital neurological pathways and wire them in a way that they're coming together in an integrative way, that a lot of the communication, the relating, the engagement, imaginative play, imaginative thinking, creative thought, a lot of those things can come into focus and be, the sensory piece can be built upon. So he's less reactive and overreactive to sensation because it's integrated now. He's less obsessive. There aren't any bags under his eyes, no stomach aches. He's more patient and less mean to his sister, and his tics stopped. And so I've had this boy on a liquid, an LM, one, that his mom has found, you know, I really stick with minimal dose, really trying to avoid aggravation. And, you know, I want to say really briefly, you know, I was part of the homeopathy SNC group, and in my own practice, I've moved almost exclusively to using medicinal solution or liquid remedies now, and I still have cases. The first case that I described, the tarantula case, was a dry dose, and this child is recovered, and so dry dosing does have its place. But what I like about using liquid remedies and medicinal solution is the way also that it's described, is that there's so much more flexibility. You know, the number of succussions that you use when you're succussing the remedy, the number of drops into the 4 ounces of distilled water, there's a lot more leeway, and I think also less chance of aggravation. And of course, first do no harm. I don't want my patients to aggravate. You know, sometimes that happens, and sometimes, you know, it's unavoidable. You'll give a single dose of an LM1, And the patient will aggravate, but really I want to try to avoid that. And I found that using liquid remedies, I'm able to have more flexibility and control about how strong the remedy is that I'm giving the person, and more flexibility and more control in dosing. So this mother has really found empirically that one dose every 3 to 4 weeks is what works for this child. So, I want to talk a little bit about what kind of response I expect from a remedy that's working. And to kind of tie this together with the light of engagement and relating, I'm really evaluating the effectiveness of a remedy by the larger gestalt. Are we moving in the right direction? And there are landmarks that when I initially take a case, I'm seeing, are we moving in a direction where that light of engagement is shining bright? Is there recognition? Is there responsiveness? Is the child having an easier time at being in the present and being in presence with another? Is there an experience of love and warmth, both giving and receiving? Is that light shining bright? Are they relating? Are they able to emotionally self-regulate? Are they integrating, you know, their senses to have a coherent experience? Sensorially. there a decreased need for control and need to manipulate one's environment? And again, sensory is huge. You know, integrated internal and external sensory experience, integration of the nervous system's vital pathways. Are we refining and strengthening those? What about the child's sleep? Is that improving? Are their fears diminishing? Are they more embracing the world in a less fearful way? Are they having intentional and purposeful interaction, intentional emotional interaction? Is there back and forth two-way communication happening? Is there problem solving, joint attention, these higher order creative thinking and imaginative play? Those are really good signs. If that starts to happen, you know, and the language is coming in, and they're starting to have imaginative play, and it's not just parallel play with other kids, but they're really engaging other kids and in their passions, and it's two-way. That's really exciting to see. And that light is shining bright for them at that point.
It's really important to point these out to parents because they kind of, you know, when things start getting more normal, you take it for granted. You kind of forget how things used to be.
It's a process, and these things build upon themselves. You know, the imaginative play, the creative play, the social interaction, the two-way communication, joint attention, that's all really based on an integrated sensory experience. You know, if things are discordant and dissonant, if the sound that you're hearing is overwhelming, if that sensation of the hum of the fluorescent lights is interrupting your sensory experience, it's really hard to get to communication that's fluid.
So anyway, I hate to cut you off, but we have just a couple more minutes, so I want you to, you know, think, what message would you like to convey to parents, you know, in conclusion, like how they can, you know, best maximize homeopathy, how they can, you know, maximize this chance that their child will be helped?
Yeah. Well, you know, I really rely on parents of the children that I'm teaching. I rely on their observation skills and, you know, their ability to describe, I mean, arriving at the correct homeopathic remedy is really going to hinge on my really understanding inside and out what is most characteristic, what is most individualizing, what is most unique about this child, what makes them tick. And so, you know, particularly of parents with infants or parents of children on the spectrum that are nonverbal, I really rely on their powers of observation. You know, and I think that although some cases really there is an immediate response, you know, I there's one child that I'm thinking about that I'm writing up this case for homeopathy today, a child with dyspraxia and sensory processing issues. And this child, we know he needs a redose of his remedy when his stims return. And his stims abate within 48 hours, typically, of taking the remedy. And so, you know, I really rely heavily on the parents, you know, their observation skills, and being able to convey that to me is really important. And I think also patience. You know, sometimes homeopathy, although sometimes children do respond immediately, often there's more of a gradual, and the changes are subtle, and you look back over, you know, 4 months, 6 months, 9 months, and you know, and this is why I take such meticulous notes. I try to take everything verbatim when I take a case. And so I go back to that initial consultation 9 months ago, and I say, well, this is what was happening with this child when we first spoke. What's happening now? And so we'll compare, you know, how well is the child engaging? How well are they relating? Are they responding in a way where they're understanding the pragmatics of speech and saying things that are in the context and not tangential, for example? All of that's important. And so, but sometimes it is more subtle and sometimes it is more gradual. And like you mentioned, and I'll reiterate this again, but as the light increases, you know, it is, as we move towards springtime and the summer solstice and the summer when the days are the longest, it is like that sometimes, where there's a little more light each day, and we see this child open up and engage with the world around them and shine their bright that much brighter and receive the illumination and love and warmth of people around them. And that happens more gradually, but that's what I'm wanting to see, and I know that a remedy is working when that begins to happen.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
It's really, really nice. So hold on. I'm sure everybody else thanks you, too. Hold on, and I'm going to pause the program, okay?
Okay.
Okay, well, that's about all we have time for. We went really long today. Just a reminder, too, to check out the ImpossibleCure.com website and also to go to the website of the National Center for Homeopathy, nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. If you join, you'll also get their wonderful magazine, Homeopathy Today, that Ian mentioned. And, in fact, he's got an article in the issue that just came out. His article's called Tuesdays with Ingrid. It's about kind of a hospice type of case, a woman dying from cancer. And also, the NCH website has lots of info about treating colds and flu and things like that, which are always important during the winter months. So, anyway, be well. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy solstice. And remember, there truly is hope with homeopathy.